This episode of TWIM is brought to you by the new voice-activated Sync featuring hands-free calling, music, and podcast search, and turn-by-turn navigation. Available exclusively on Ford, Lincoln, and Mercury vehicles. For more details, visit SyncMyRidePodcast.com. And to enter to win a free Nano or Zune, send a tweet with hashtag SyncMyRidePodcast. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to This Week in Media. It's Alex Lindsay here. I'm sitting in. Daisy is not able to run the show today, but we will. But she's, of course, coming back next week with lots of good stuff. But I'm here, of course, with one of the other usual suspects, Tim Street. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Alex. How's it going, man?
It's going well. And also, we have Brady Brim DeForest back. Hey, Brady.
Hey, how are you?
Good, good. Good to have you here again. And before we go any further, I just want to thank our sponsor, Ford, and their new voice-activated Sync. And of course, now Sync, as you know, it's going to listen to your voice so the Sync knows what to do when you tell it to play TWIM or call home or play your favorite playlist. I mean, this is really, we're talking Star Trek kind of stuff. I mean, this is really something that is where cars should have been, in my opinion, a long time ago. And I'm really excited that Ford is finally really taking a leadership role in this. I mean, it makes me actually want to go out and check out a Ford and look at it, because this is what I think a lot of us have thought was coming any year now. Well, it's here. I mean, you can get turn-by-turn navigation. You can even get weather and traffic updates. And all of it, of course, is hands-free. So there's not a lot of punching around on your dashboard. There's no punching around on your driver's wheel. None of that stuff is necessary. It's hands-free. It's just using the sound of your voice. Now, if you want to get more details, you can go to SyncMyRidePodcast.com. And even if you're not in the mode for a car, you should just check this out, because the technology is just, I think we're going to see it in cars, other cars down the road. But I think that Ford is just really, doing a great job of getting it out there, and definitely check it out at SyncMyRidePodcast.com. Now, if you want to win a Nano or a Zune, of course, you can just tweet with a hashtag and put SyncMyRidePodcast. So it's a hashtag, SyncMyRidePodcast. Definitely check it out. Lots of really pretty interesting news coming up here, so we're going to dive right into it. One of the things I think really topping this off, and I think it's exciting. I don't know if it's exciting to anyone else, but one of the things that I'm excited about is this new YouTube video targeting, advertising service. Tim, can you give us a little information about that?
Sure. So what YouTube is launching, a video targeting service, so that if there's a popular video that you think fits your brand, your service, your product, you can advertise on it. So the basic spin of it that comes to us from Mashable, there's an article from Mashable, is that you could put your ad on the JK wedding dance. But besides that, you could stick it on the dancing doctors in pink gloves, or just about any other video that's part of the YouTube partner program. And they've changed things around a little bit differently, where in the past you had to, get a certain amount of views and then contact YouTube, or they would contact you. Now, if they see that a video is getting a lot of views, they'll go ahead and put it into their program and work out the business side of it later, so that it does monetize and that those views don't go wasted.
Well, I think that's really important, because I think one of the issues that you get into is that people want to, you want to monetize from day one. I mean, if there's 100,000 or 200,000 or 300,000 impressions, you want that to be part of the calculation as a producer. And so now this looks like it's currently only available to people who are, really part of the partner program. It's not like AdSense, where anyone can kind of sign up and then just say, oh, I want my ad, because that's not something you can really manage, right?
Right. It's got to be triggered by a bunch of views.
Right. But also, the person who wants to put the advertising on it needs to, they need to be able to. It's not just anybody can put an ad on any video right now. They have to, figure out how to schedule that. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. But all signs point to that. It's coming, so that you can, if you have a business and you want to advertise, that's what you're going to be able to do.
What do you think, Brady? What do you think about all of this?
I think it's great. I mean, I think for advertisers, this definitely gives them the ability to hyper-target specific eyeballs. I think for content creators, it's yet to be seen if this is going to push the spins on the media buy side into some fairly narrow channels, or if this is actually going to increase, you know, the efficiency of the spins on the advertiser side. So I think there's some pluses and minuses here, but definitely overall, this is a great tool that YouTube's turning on, and I think it's going to help you know, videos that are already doing really well to be monetized better by the creators themselves.
And one of the things when we say monetize, this is really something that affects the creator. And one of the questions we had in the IRC is, does the video creator get any money? And they absolutely do. There is some money. Oh, I think not always, but I think that they, if you're within the program, I mean, you're really working on it, you can get that. You're getting a share of that. Isn't that correct, Tim?
Yeah, I'm part of the YouTube Partner Program, and so for the videos that I put on, ads get attached, overlays, pre-rolls, that type of thing, and then I get a nice little deposit into my checking account every month from YouTube.
Yeah, and so I think that this is, you know, as people are trying to build more and more creative, whether it's narrative or how-tos or whatever, and I think this combined with 1080p solutions, which YouTube is putting out, really starts to make me wonder whether we're going to, you know, how this affects television, you know, because it, you know, we keep on talking about this, but now, you know, when we started doing 1080p 3 years ago for the web, people thought it was a little nutty, you know, to be doing, why are you doing 1080p when everyone else was doing maybe 640 by 360? But now, you know, we're really getting to the point, 1080p is the production resolution for the web, TV, and film. You know, we're really getting down to one singular resolution as we start to move forward. As we do this, is it going to be harder for? What does this mean for TV? Do we think it's going to really be something that affects them, or it'll just be another thing that the web's doing that doesn't really affect how TV operates?
I think it's death by a thousand cuts. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. Everything that's drawing attention away from your show is drawing attention away. I mean, if you go back in time and look at the early days of television, you know, radio people thought there wasn't a chance that, you know, TV was going to be around. It was just a passing fad. And there are no radio dramas anymore. They don't exist.
Right.
I hope we don't see the same thing happen with television dramas, because I kind of like those.
Well, and I think also when we have blog, you know, when blogs came out, they were this little thing that people were kind of doing, and now we're seeing, you know, them eviscerating, essentially, and as you said, death by a thousand cuts, the print industry. You know, it's very, very difficult for them to operate. It's very difficult for them to monetize, because the blogs aren't charging. Most of them aren't, which makes it very hard for the newspapers too. You know, because that information is going to get out one way or the other. And so it is something that, and they were closer to the ground. You know, of the groundswell. You know, so that I think we can see that possibly replicating itself. And as I said, I think that this combined with the 1080p, you know, issues, it turns into something that's fairly interesting. Now, Brady, do you think the 1080p mixed with the advertising is really going to be something that is a real challenge to TV?
I think it's a great question. I think part of the value of television is the ubiquity of the platform itself. And also its simplicity. So we all have televisions in our homes. Now, some of us, like myself, don't have cable or, you know, rabbit ears hooked up. So we don't actually consume television in the traditional fashion, in a traditional sense. But ultimately, I think the discovery issue, how content is delivered to the end user, is going to be a lot more important piece of the battle than necessarily the technical delivery of the content. So, well, I think for some folks, 1080p, you know, really high quality HD content is definitely an upsell. But ultimately, I think it's going to be the availability and the discoverability of content that's going to pull people away from TV and onto the net.
Right. Very good. Now, also in the news, Apple is in quote unquote advanced talks, and there's a lot of rumors. I think that they've already come to an agreement with Layla. Tim, can you give us a little more information about this development?
Well, it's a streaming service that that Apple has acquired, and a lot of people are like, "Uh-oh, what does this mean? What does this mean?" I think, you know, there's a play for a subscription model now with iTunes, so that you can subscribe, listen to streaming music, listen to the types of music you want. Some people are speculating, though, that Apple did this, you know, not only for the business side of it, but in acquiring this service, they're taking it out of the Google search environment. So I don't know if that's true, but it is an interesting thing with the Google Music search that just launched last month, I think it was, or maybe the month before. It's interesting to see that this is happening shortly thereafter.
Now, Brady, do you think that we're going to see a subscription service from Apple?
I think it makes total sense to me. I think that it's a huge hole in their service offering, or their offering on iTunes today. And honestly, it's, you know, it's left a lot of room to play for other services that don't have the, you know, the iTunes market dominance in terms of the pay per download. I think once they turn on streaming, once they turn on a subscription service, it's going to be game over for a lot of these other companies, mainly because Apple owns the entire value chain. So they own the devices, they own the distribution, and you know, they're also now playing in the original content game, more so on the video side than on the music side, obviously. But that being said, being able to control the user experience across the entire value chain, and the fact that they have over 100 million credit cards already in iTunes, is an incredible advantage. And you know, they have a much deeper penetration on the desktop and on the device side, the mobile device side, than almost any other you know, distributor out there. So from that perspective, I think they have all the advantages. And it really comes down to, are they going to kind of play it the typical Apple way, where they force us into a very small room with four walls, or are they going to make the streaming service a little bit more flexible and make it look like, you know, like the Netflix streaming service, or, you know, make it look, I honestly think there's a lot of different ways it could go. And so it's really about execution, but all the cards are there. They could do it well if they wanted to.
Well, I mean, I have to admit that I think that if Apple had a subscription service, and part of this is also that they already have a security system. So if you wanted to have, you know, FairPlay is all still there. It's all still available, even though, you know, we have open, you know, now you're buying everything. When you're buying, and I think that they also have a clear value proposition where you can buy a 256-bit, unimpeded, non-DRM single, or you can download a whole bunch at 128 or whatever, 96. I don't really care what that is to constantly sample it. I mean, I have to admit that as someone now who regularly carries around both a Zune and an iPhone, I find that the Zune marketplace is for me much more of a music lover's marketplace than iTunes, simply because I can, you know, I'm just like, oh, I've never heard of this band, or my brother mentioned this band, and I just downloaded all their albums. on my subscription, I just downloaded all of them. I say, well, I'm going to listen to it for a little while, and I'm going to see whether I like it or not. You know, and I think that is something that is sorely missing from the Apple thing. I think exactly what you said. And I do think that the question that I have is, if Apple goes down that path, do they start getting themselves into trouble with possible antitrust, you know, issues?
That's interesting. I'm curious, why did you go to the Zune? What put you there?
Why did I go to the Zune? I got a Zune specifically because I thought it was the best player that would interact with kind of the computer back and forth, and the best player that I could get that had a subscription service. I literally bought it for the subscription service, just because I wanted to have something that I could, and I felt like, you know, I'm constantly talking about these devices, and we also, one of the other reasons we got it is we want to put our podcasts on it, and I needed to test it. So I needed to figure out how, you know, I needed to have one so I could figure out how to get the podcasts.
And you got the HD one?
I got the HD one.
Isn't that beautiful screen? Rob Greenlee showed me that, and I was like, whoa.
It is. It's a gorgeous screen. I still don't quite understand the navigation completely, so I get kind of lost, and I end up kind of having to circle back. It's not. It's more beautiful. I find it to be less intuitive than the iPhone, but it's also just something that I have to learn a little bit better. But I do just, it is, I got the Zune, and I stopped buying songs on iTunes. You know, it was like, I'll buy them every once in a while. I mean, if I'm going to buy a song, I'm not buying it on the Zune marketplace. I do buy it on the iPhone just because that's kind of where my audio collection is. But I buy so little because I just have a subscription fee and I'm downloading lots and lots of stuff. It doesn't have everything. So I'm still buying, like, especially African bands that I buy a lot of. and some more obscure stuff. You know, it'll be weird. It'll have some of the, some Genesis, but not some of the older ones, or it'll have this or not that. And so it's not like it has everything, but it is so great, especially for non-pop, not non-top 40 new music. Almost all of them have bought into the subscription service because that's another way to make money, and they're not, getting a lot of airplay. And so it's really easy to get all their albums and listen to it and get exposed to it. And I think there's so much that can be done there. And I think that we're only seeing a small fraction of what could be done with subscription services when companies, I want to say little companies like Microsoft, but companies that have a much smaller foot in music than Apple. If Apple jumped into it, I think that it's, it would change the way we think of subscription services. I think that the other thing is that Apple either has the advantage or is in danger by having things like Logic, where that they already own, and GarageBand. They are 2 inches away from being a Krupp's Arms kind of vertical market, where they have everything from the creator sitting there, in their garage making their album, all the way to the end product. I mean,
it's pretty amazing.
It's frightening. And as I said, I think that you start getting into, because you could, right now you can send to iTunes. What happens when you can be in GarageBand and say send to the iTunes music store? Like that's the, and it's like one drop down away from, just being able to publish, to straight to iTunes with some kind, of course they probably have the same problem they have with the App Store. But I think that, but that starts to then worry people about whether, you're talking about, you start getting into antitrust.
I did see a tweet today. I think it was from Sean Percival, where he was looking for an application that allowed you to sort through your iTunes and kind of edit out songs and get the correct artwork, which I thought was a very facetious tweet. But at the same time, I kind of been having trouble finding album art lately too. So it's interesting.
Yeah. What were we going to say, Brady?
To Tim's point, there's actually a couple little applications that'll scrape Amazon and will pull album artwork from Amazon and populate all of your old music, portions of your music library. But I think regarding the antitrust or possibilities here, I think that Apple has been very good about so far skirting those lines. And I mean, they already effectively control a huge portion of the portable music ecosystem in terms of the hardware and the distribution outlet. But I have a sense that they're going to be clever enough to make some very specific decisions about how to move forward, and I'm not sure if they would necessarily allow, for that kind of the GarageBand, the entire creation to distribution element. I think there's a lot of intense implications in terms of policing that kind of marketplace. And clearly, the App Store, I think, is a perfect analogy. But because of the simplicity of producing music, I imagine that iTunes would suddenly have a very serious quality control issue if absolutely anyone could simply, with a click of a button, publish music. And I think implications for copyright and for licensing and royalties are very immense. And so I think while they're in a good position to do it, I'm questioning whether or not they would actually take that step, mainly because I'm not sure how much upside there is. I think while the long tail content argument is compelling, how much of an infrastructure would they have to build out to support, I think, the size of that marketplace, and ultimately how much would they be making on those transactions? I'm not sure.
Well, I think the question also, though, is that would you could manage it theoretically not through purchases, but through like the way they do podcasting, which is pretty much anybody can put up a podcast. And if someone complains about it, they take it down, but they're not really slowing anything down when they put stuff up on, whether they should or not is a whole other story. But podcasts are kind of have been, for the most part, a wide open forum for people to be able to put up whatever they want. And then you have the paid subscriptions. I think one of the big reasons that Apple hasn't done anything like that is specifically billing, that you don't want to be hooked on the hook to send out, you know, thousands of checks that are, you know, for $10, you know, and so they've been quite happy to let clearinghouses like CD Baby, for instance, but people can put their stuff on CD Baby. CD Baby will get it into iTunes through their specific processes. So you can get into iTunes, you know, through that, or you have been able to for quite some time. And so so that's one way that you can get it on. It does take a little bit more work than publish from your Logic. But I think that, you know, my opinion is that if bands aren't making any money making CDs, you know, why not just, why are we paying for them in the first place? I mean, really, bands are making money on live performances. I mean, that's where the money is performance, not so much, say, you know, audio sales at this point. Statistically, I mean, at least for the large bands, you know. But that's a whole other conversation. Video demos increase sales conversions at Zappos. I thought this was kind of an interesting one. So this is according to Tim, why don't you give us a little information on exactly what's going on here?
Well, it looks like I'm working off a different page.
I jumped a little bit further down. I jumped a little further down. So this was talking about.
Scroll down.
But I couldn't. All I saw was sales impact of 6-30%.
Yeah. So Zappos, the online shoe company, which is a great company. I don't know if you've ever used it or not, but you can buy a pair of shoes. They'll send them to your house. If you don't like them, you send them back and you get your money back. So it's no risk shoe buying via the internet.
That's
pretty
where I got mine.
And they're also really known for their service. They have great, great service. And they recently sold their company to Amazon for like $9-something million. I forget what it was. And last year they had like $1.2 billion in sales. So they've started using video demos to increase their sales conversions at their website. So it's another great thing for video. You know, it's just the power of video. Everyone's embracing it, and we're starting to see some of it pay off.
Weren't you talking about was it in one of our earlier Twins? I can never remember where I hear this stuff. Is that video marketing and video production is one of the number one things people are looking at for as they go into next year, as far as ad reps? You know, they're talking about marketing and ad reps. There was a convention and someone was talking, and I don't remember where I heard it or which show I was on, but they're really talking about the fact that web video and these types of support things are going to be one of the biggest things that people are looking at next year.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, we all thought it was going to happen this year, but the right. recession really took their eyes off of that ball. But it makes sense. I mean, you think about how with online video, you can target a specific community, get your message across, and you're not paying the same rates that you would pay for TV. And in some cases, you know, if you're using YouTube, you're getting it for free. Now, when does that stop? I don't know. When does YouTube stop subsidizing bandwidth? That's really going to affect the independent content creator. But that's another conversation.
It's a compelling question, though, Tim. I think, you know, YouTube subsidizing this entire independent world of content is a very interesting question. Apparently, the cost structure is significantly different than that which most of us had assumed, seeing as how Google owns, you know, or leases a lot of dark fiber. But I think that's a very interesting question, is how efficient is this really if you have to pay for distribution? Because right now, the physical distribution of the content is free. And so it makes it, you know, there's a very different cost structure compared to television where you have to buy airtime.
You should definitely take advantage of it. I mean, if you have a product or service and you're not making videos and sticking them up on YouTube right now, you're crazy.
Now, is all Zappos stuff going to YouTube, or are they doing their own thing?
You know what? I don't know. I think they're doing their own thing at their website, but I would imagine they've also got a channel on YouTube as well. I mean, it's just even Bing. Microsoft has videos on YouTube. I mean, you got to take advantage of it while you can.
Well, yeah, and I don't think it's going to go away. I think that I think if they can figure out how to monetize it, a lot of this is statistics. You know, figuring that a certain number of them are going to go big enough that you can sell ads against, you make it available for, you know, everyone else. Although you see these big companies taking advantage of YouTube, and you wonder, you know, because they're putting it up there because they don't want to think about the bandwidth, they don't want to think about the incremental billing. It's not that it's too much money; they just don't want to. If something goes big, they don't want to be on the hook for another, you know, $4,000 or whatever. They'd rather.
I don't want to be on the hook for it either.
yeah, exactly. And that's why people put it up. But I think that it is very interesting that when you look at the efficiency, I think part of it is the recovery of the economy may lead to a lot of these videos because they increase productivity. You have, you know, you do it once, and especially if you build it, it looks like they're building 10 studios, I think, to shoot these. They want to shoot, I mean, it was an insane number of videos, and I don't have it right in front of me. Oh, 50,000 videos next year. They currently have about 8,000 videos. So this is, I guess, this is a video about every shoe that they own, or every shoe that they sell, or how to do different things.
Well, they don't just sell shoes anymore either. You know, right. Now they're owned by Amazon. So who knows what all the videos are going to be? But, you know, I mean, it's an interesting play because it's similar to demand media where, you know, they figure out what people are searching for and they make a video about it. Now, it's usually a cheap video. It doesn't cost much. I mean, it might just be a single camera, no editing. You know, it's just from start to finish, it's all in-camera editing, but they get those videos out there, and they produce 4,000 pieces of content a day, and that's video and blogging content. But with that, they get incredible search results.
Right. And I think that there's when you look at the power of video, I mean, the thing is that you really can't, I mean, you're looking at that many. I've always been amazed that Amazon didn't get into this, and they're not directly getting into it yet, but that they haven't gotten into this much earlier. I mean, they've made it available for people to put their own comments up about products, but it just seems like such an obvious thing to have shows about, you know, stuff and reviews and all kinds of other things, you know, within Amazon.com. I've been surprised that we haven't seen that, you know, yet. And so it's interesting to see at least one company starting to take some of that. And I think we've seen Audible also, which is another Amazon company, you know, starting to do some video vignettes to try to, you know, promote some of the stuff they're doing. Brady, do you think we're going to see a lot more of this?
Absolutely. I think Howcast, which I think Tim just mentioned, you know, is a great example of a site that is creating a lot of compelling content very cheaply. And I think video as a sales tool can be incredibly effective. And as Tim said, anyone that isn't using videos, you know, you got to question you have to ask why. I mean, it makes complete sense. It's really inexpensive to produce in mass quantities, especially if you set it up, you know, like a production line and you make a video for one product and then another and then another. And ultimately, you know, if those numbers that Zappos is reporting are really true, I mean, that's incredible. That has a real substantial impact on ROI. Yeah. And that's hard to ignore.
Yeah, absolutely. Also in the news, and probably should have talked about this one at the top, we have GE and Comcast have announced the deal that Comcast is buying NBC Universal. Tim, can you give us a little bit more information about this?
Doesn't that just sound crazy to you? Somebody's buying NBC Universal. I mean, GE bought it, right?
I know,
but that's GE, right? You know, the interesting thing about this is several years back, I think it was like 2004, 2005, Comcast was trying to buy Disney. Right. And that didn't happen. The deal didn't go through. But it looks like this deal's going through, and that Comcast, this story comes to us from TV Week, that Comcast will take 51% stake in NBC Universal. And so they'll get a hold of all the broadcast business and the theme parks. And it's a little bit disturbing.
The only parallel that I can think of is, you know, this would be like AOL buying Warner Brothers.
Yeah, and that didn't go so well, did it?
No. Yeah, just ask Ted Turner.
Yeah, although it's interesting because with AOL, their business model at that time was dial-up. And I don't know if it was dying at the time that they bought Warner Brothers, but it's a dying business, right? Is cable a dying business?
Or is TV a dying business? You know, is broadcast. Now, Brady, do you think this is gonna turn out to be a good investment on Comcast's part?
It's a great question. I think most major mergers, 5 years out, tend to look a lot different than they do going in. I think Tim's question about is cable, going to look like dial-up 10 years from now. I would argue that, you know, Comcast, or, you know, AT&T, even these major telecommunications companies, really the bread and butter of their operation is, you know, the hundreds of thousands of folks in some cases that they employ to actually lay the physical cable in the ground. And so what they have is they have a distribution system, a physical distribution system that allows them to pump content out, you know, through it. And for Comcast specifically, you know, whether the cable that they have in the ground delivers television or delivers IP data, I don't think it really matters. So, I mean, the fact that you know, they're investing in the world of content, the reality is they already do, and they already own a lot of different cable networks. And I think the increasing fragmentation of the entertainment world, it means that ultimately, I think NBC isn't going to be nearly as valuable as a network brand as it was 10 years ago. So I think what they're buying into is the IP. They're buying into the movie studio, to Universal.
Well, isn't this also a hedge against, or is it a hedge against the risk of the cable company or cable companies becoming just commoditized, becoming just the pipe? You know, because you know they're making money right now on being a lot more than that, delivering content and so on and so forth. But where it really looks like we're going is as we start moving more and more towards internet video and all these other pieces, is that we don't really care about their cable service. We just want a fast 50 megabit pipe or 100 megabit pipe, and we don't care who does that as long as it happens all the time. And so and by owning the content, you get to hedge a little against that might be the future.
That's certainly what they're hoping for. I mean, if you look at what's going on with MGM right now, so, you know, they've got this incredible library of content, but that's all they have. And MGM, you know, has seen better times. And, you know, clearly the physical assets of the business, are long gone. They have this catalog material, and the $2 billion valuation that's being discussed for MGM today, you know, about $1.5 billion of that is based on the Bond franchise. So, you know, I don't know how valuable the Universal library content necessarily is. I think, you know, the infrastructure for creating the content is probably, you know, in reference to your point, is probably the most valuable piece of the acquisition.
Really? You don't? I think the library is. I think having all that library asset to pump through the pipe and monetize is the real value, especially when you think about how it's going to roll out internationally. Comcast has created a lot of content already with the channels that they own, and they've got a lot of experience already with online video. And in the cable world, they refer to online video as over the top, meaning that it's not coming through the normal cable box. It's coming over the top into the home through the DSL, cable modem, whatever. And this, to me, seems really about the content itself, not necessarily the making of it, but acquiring that library and the future things that will come, of course.
And maybe just on the value for Comcast with the on-demand, by owning NBC, you know, I'm a Comcast subscriber, and I have, you know, I watch a lot of on-demand, but I'm limited. You
Does
know,
it where get
you
throttled? Do they throttle it?
No, the on-demand.
I'm kidding.
I started suspecting I was getting throttled actually lately because we watch a lot of Roku, you know, a lot of the, Netflix, Instaplay. And I do know that somewhere lurking there is a 250 gig cap. And they just put out a measurement tool for it, which I haven't been able to figure out how to make it work. But, which, you know, I think we talked about last week. I mean, we might have mentioned this last week, and I'm going to actually probably use more content with the measurement tool than I had before, because I'll just max it out every month. You know, if I get to the last week and I've only used 150 gigs, I'll just be like downloading, I don't know, just raw data. You know, I'll just be, you know, I'm just going to download parts of the internet.
I don't understand this unlimited services. Like my AT&T Wi-Fi card, 5 gig, it's unlimited, but you only get 5 gigs. What?
Yeah, no, that's that one. That one I'm very clear of. I have my Verizon EVDO, and you get that limit, and so I'm very careful about, you know, how much data I push through my. I just check my email mostly with my EVDO, but I do think it does. It could really change if they have all the Universal and all the NBC stuff. It really could change how much they gave away for free, you know, to attract more subscribers, as well as making sure that DVR/on-demand service is more valuable to the to the viewer. You know, I think that's something that's fairly important. Also in the news, BBC and P2P are testing the HD BitTorrent streaming. Tim, can you give us a little more information?
So this apparently, I think this one comes to us from New TV, and apparently the EU is funding a P2P Next project where the BBC has started streaming content in true 1080p HD via BitTorrent, which is kind of cool. Yeah. Now, the project posted an episode of the BBC's R&D TV on its technical trial website this week, with the option to stream it either at regular 480p or full HD 1080p. But the bad part is that users, they have to first install a plugin, and it's currently only available for Windows.
That's pretty rough.
Yeah, it's rough.
Yeah, that's very rough.
Now, the EU has funded this P2P Next project with 14 million euros. That's about $20.8 million. So kind of cool. Now, the other thing that's cool about this is that Pioneer, the manufacturer of Pioneer, has partnered to produce a P2P set-top box prototype. So that makes it even more exciting because, you know, one of the tough things about online video is that it's a great one-to-one service, but it's a really bad one-to-many service. It's not as efficient as broadcast. And the cool thing about BitTorrent has been it's fairly efficient at you know, casting your material everywhere. So the fact that the BBC is, you know, that BitTorrent has gone legal, and you know, they're a respectable company, and I guess they always have been. They just got a bad name because pirates use their technology to steal content. But this is pretty cool.
Well, I think this was a lot of times their argument was that many times they were talking about the fact that you could use it for all of this stuff, and one of the things that once you start accepting that BitTorrent's there and we're not fighting it, there are a lot of efficiencies that can be gathered for instance, the ISPs as well as the individual user to get this stuff out more effectively. For instance, putting boxes at the at the hubs, you know, for the ISP to make sure that you're BitTorrenting back to people based on people that are already in your network. So Comcast doesn't have to go out and use somebody else's network to, you know, through the BitTorrent, they can buffer and then repeat stuff that's going out that's being very popular, and being able to, you know, kind of route the IPs together so that they're not, so that it reduces cost. You know, a lot of things like that can be done to make it a lot more efficient. Also, cascading. Now, one of the problems with BitTorrent is that you get too many people, too many peers, and not enough seeds. And if you have a box that can be controlled, one of the things that you can do is actually to say, okay, we're going to send it out to 10, then flip it to 100, then flip it to 1,000, then flip it to 50,000, you know, and have it be something that happens slowly when people aren't even paying attention, if there's a set-top box that's actually managing that. And so it'll be interesting. Brady, do you think we're going to see a lot more BitTorrent? Do you think this is going to be something that that is the beginning of something, or just an experiment that kind of fizzles?
It's a great question, actually, and it really relates well to the last conversation we were having about Comcast. You know, Time Warner, Comcast, there have been, you know, isolated incidents, reports where there is, you know, protocol discrimination on the part of the ISPs, and I think that that's going to be a very interesting fight that I think we see play out publicly and behind closed doors, because of the fact that BitTorrent can be used for some nefarious purposes and has a bad rap. You know, with deep packet inspection and the different technologies in the toolkit of the ISPs, you know, how much are they going to be filtering these protocols based on the fact that they can be used for pirated, you know, content? I think that's going to be really an interesting dilemma is how much filtering is actually going to be happening on the part of the ISPs, and is that going to negatively affect the protocol and it as a legitimizing influence in you know, in that regard.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like the pirated content's a problem. It seems like the legitimate content that you're getting through your Roku box or whatever is going to be the problem for cable companies.
because they're not getting any added benefit, right? I mean, so
they're not making any money on that other than just being a dumb pipe.
And it's I think that's the real risk for them. And I think that it's a valid risk, because I know for us, every day we watch more Roku and less TV. You know, and if there were certain shows, you know, for me, if Alton Brown was on the Roku, and I think for my wife, if Oprah was on the Roku, we'd probably go to Comcast and watch TV probably, 10%, 5% of the time. I think those are the only two things that I surf around looking for at this point.
I completely agree. But my point was that because these protocols have been used in the past and they have a stigma related to them that's associated with piracy, it's a lot easier then for the cable companies, for the ISPs, to justify turning those protocols off because of the threat of piracy,
right?
Regardless of how real that is, they can use that to justify shutting down those protocols and therefore preventing what Tim just talked about, which is becoming a dumb pipe. So, while I think the vast majority of BitTorrent traffic is probably legitimate in most cases, the ISPs can take that argument and the fact that pirated content exists on those networks and is transferred via those protocols and can use that as a justification for turning them off, which is very dangerous. And that's why Comcast owning the content and having a hand in the content business as well as owning the pipe is a very scary future.
Well, but it's also, in some ways, it's good for us because they have something to gain out of having, they have something to gain from being able to have, they're not, if they're no longer the pipe, if they become no longer just a pipe trying to protect their pipe and they're a content distributor, they might be less likely to do the clampdowns that we've seen otherwise, because, they're going to win either way. And in fact, their problem, if they're dealing with distribution of content from an NBCU perspective, is they want that content to be available over everybody's cable networks, through the internet connection, not through necessarily through cable only. And so it might actually put us in a better position, but I don't know if they're that smart. So we'll see. We'll see if that actually works.
Hey, it's, what do they have? 40 million subscribers at $100 a month.
It's not a bad business model. They're smart. Yeah. They're evidently smarter than me.
Yeah. I don't think they want to give that up anytime soon.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that they don't have to. I think that the thing is when we're talking about net neutrality, we're not talking about the end user, really. Net neutrality is mostly, is Google going to pay more to put YouTube out there? Is other things, because as the end user, we're very far away from net neutrality. I mean, we pay different amounts of money for different speeds of connections. And I think that I'm a person that I can see myself 5 years from now paying $150 a month for a 100 megabit connection.
Making $50 a month.
Well, but if they decide to ratchet it up, but my whole thing is I don't need a phone. I don't need my cable net, cable TV. Yep. I don't need anything. Just give me a big fat pipe. Let me know that it's going to be, I'm not being limited to 250 gigs a month. I can do 100 megs down and 100 megs up. And by the way,
if somebody didn't know what we were talking about, they would think this was all drug references. Yeah, just give me a big fat pipe.
Yeah, just give me a fat pipe, man. And I am set, dude. You don't need to, I don't need TV, man. And I don't need the telephone.
And the distributor is going to bring it to my house.
That's all I need, man. I just want to know I don't have any limits, dude. So
content's the drug, right?
yeah, exactly. Well, and
it is.
And I really got that when I was in Japan and had a 100 megabit symmetrical connection. And man, it just changes the way you look at everything. Because you just
awesome.
You can watch everything. Everything's a snap. Anything you want to watch.
Now, while we're on the subject of net neutrality, real quick, Brady, isn't there a vote coming up in February? And haven't a lot of these companies hired like about 200 lobbyists to hit Washington?
Absolutely. There's a huge battle that's playing out, and there was a point. I'm not sure who raised it earlier, but it really is now about pipeline discrimination. So it's about who's going to pay, for the ability to preferentially push their content out. So from the end user perspective, net neutrality is important in terms of what content we'll be able to access, and will the independents be able to play with the big guys if discrimination is a factor in what is being referred to as reasonable network management. And so from that perspective, you know, the FCC has really been championing, you know, the cause, preventing discrimination on the distribution side. And there's actually a FCC filing comment period that closes on the 9th, which is 2 days from now. And if you haven't submitted a filing to the FCC, you know, arguing for, you know, anti-discrimination, then I would definitely suggest you do it. You can go to FCC.gov and there's a filing, a comment submission form, and you can actually send in your comments. And this is a really important time to do that. The more that we can speak out about this issue, the greater possibility that we can give the necessary ammo to Julius Jankowski and the other commissioners to actually fight this battle for us.
Well, I mean, it could affect shows like this show that you're listening or watching right now.
Well, and I think that the other thing is the FCC rudimentarily knows what they're talking about when it comes to all this, but one of the real dangers seems to be that members of the House and Senate want to now get in on it because, of course, you know, they get a lot of money from, you know, cable companies so and content creators and everything else, and not as much money, I think, from the technology companies. And they want to get in on it. And to me, that seems far more dangerous than anything the FCC is going to do, because the FCC has been taking a pretty good stand on it. But what I'm really concerned about is what we're going to see from the House and Senate.
Yeah, how they can always rename a bill. You know, they can name a bill so that it looks like it's a good thing, and it has all the right buzzwords in it. But when you look at it, it's not what you thought it was.
Yeah,
which comes back to Tim's point about the lobbyists, and you know, these major media conglomerates have hundreds of lobbyists in Washington that are fighting this battle for them, and you know the free press. And the open internet, we have like one. So, you know, luckily we have some great allies in this fight, Google being one of them. But still, like you said, Google can easily, you know, they have deep enough pockets, they can pay to make sure their content isn't discriminated against. But, you know, can the rest of us? Probably not.
Yeah. Yeah, so hopefully we'll see something a little bit more happen there. So any other big news, Tim, that we missed here that you were excited about?
Do you want to look here real quick? I think can we talk about the Crunchpad litigation?
We can. I think it's been definitely. We can definitely. We talked a lot about this on MacBreak Weekly. I think I was like, oh, you know, I missed it at the bottom there. So, but yeah, Tim, give us a little information about the Crunchpad.
So TechCrunch was working on a pad, and like an iPad kind of thing. And the photo that I've seen kind of looks like it was made by Apple, doesn't it? But anyway, they were working on that with their partner, and then all of a sudden mysterious emails started showing up about how they weren't partners anymore. They weren't going to be able to deliver things anymore, and so now there's this litigation that's coming with the manufacturer of the pad and the TechCrunch folks.
And it's not the good kind of litigation.
No, it's not the good kind of litigation. So, I mean, imagine that you partner with somebody and they're supposed to build the thing that you're partnering on, and you're putting all the creative ideas into it in terms of what it will do, and you're also working on the marketing of it and how you'll market it to your fan base, and then all of a sudden the person making it goes, you know, we think we can make more money with this elsewhere.
Well, and
that's the story from the TechCrunch folks. We have yet to hear, to my knowledge, we haven't heard the story from the manufacturer folks.
Well, and I think that we talked a lot about this, as I said, on MacBreak Weekly last week, and I think that one of the things that, as someone who I got very close to trying to make a pad, so we actually went through a bunch of gyrations and processes and negotiations with a Korean company to possibly make one of these about a year ago. And one of the things is the price that they were charging for the Crunchpad was, in my opinion, too low to be sustainable. You know, I know what the parts cost. So, you know, and I don't know how, you know, just It was a great idea. It was very populist, but it was very, very low. And I think that my guess is, having dealt with some of these manufacturing companies, is it had nothing to do with the CEO over there. It had everything to do with shareholders, investors, and so on and so forth, who just took control. You know, and so the last minute thing, I don't think it was someone that was working with TechCrunch, that the person that was working directly with him, I think it was someone who, you know, had his strings and simply just said at the end, just did a reverse, you know, a right turn, and probably put them both in a lot of hot water. Now they're going to be in a lot of legal battles and so on and so forth. I think that it becomes very hard to see how you can produce one of these because there's shared resources, shared ownership, shared, you know, in a lot of those things. So I think that that's going to be the challenge, is being able to do one now. And I do think that there's a certain time limit. I think if Apple puts one out and really takes a lot of that space away, it really, if this legal battle is going to last more than 6 months, I just don't know if it's worth it. Go ahead.
Actually, while we've been talking, or actually before we started talking today, a bunch of interesting developments happened vis-a-vis the Crunchpad, the company that was based in Singapore that was doing, you know, a lot of the hardware and the software work. Fusion Garage actually had a presentation this morning in San Francisco, and they announced that they will be releasing the device called the Juju on December 11th for $499. So evidently they are moving forward with the plan to actually produce and market this device. So I think, wow, the story just got a whole lot more interesting.
Wow.
In the chat room, they're saying that you can check it out, the story out on Engadget.com, and get Fusion Garage's side of the story.
Which is something you would definitely want to know. So I think it'll be interesting to see how that turns out. I think that that number still looks hard, but I think the problem they're going to have is that without TechCrunch, that, you know, they're going to have the ability to promote it. I mean, other than all the trouble, you know, now that all they have is bad PR, and I know that all PR is theoretically good PR, but I don't think this is the PR they wanted wrapped around this thing, you know. And so I think that the issue is it may be a really heavy uphill battle to sell large numbers of units, you know, with this process.
Absolutely. I think you're right. And I think getting Mike Larrington on your bad side is not something that you want to do. He's you know, when you upset Michael, he'll take you down.
Yeah, he buys digital ink by the barrel.
Right. Yeah. So it'll be a very interesting thing to see how that goes. You know, and it is, yeah. So it's on the front page of Engadget right now, for those of you listening live. So definitely worth checking out, and they are releasing it very quickly. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I think that the problem is that at the price that they were looking at, I thought it was too low. I think the price that they now have it, which is more reasonable, I'm not sure if it has enough power. You know, I just
want the real thing. Just give me the real thing. I know we're not allowed to talk about the real thing on the show anymore, but give me the real thing.
I know. We all want that. We all want the real thing. Anyway, before we go any further, Tim, where can people find you?
You can find me at onetimstreet.com.
And Brady, where can people find you on the web?
You can find me at brimdeforest.com, but the best place to go is tubefilter.tv.
Great. This mess you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over and out.